Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is April 15th, 2015. We're convened for Phase 2 presentation on Senate Bill 5516, the budget bill of the Oregon Department of Justice. Mr. Borden, anything you want to tee up for us?
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the subcommittee. A couple quick logistical items. The agency with the Department of Administrative Services has posted responses to questions when they were here during Phase 1, and those responses are posted under the March 24th date. Additionally, just the outline for the next several days for the agency. The agency will talk about its general funding sources in the context of its budget. It will review its AG rate, its policy packages, and the impact that any of those may have to the Attorney General rate. Policy measures that may that are needed to support those policy packages, technical adjustments that will review its reduction options. So that's kind of the outline for the next few days. And then tomorrow, of course, is a work session on a joint report with the Department of Human Services, and that will be first off on the agenda tomorrow.
Okay. Great. Madam Attorney General, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields and Williamson and members of the subcommittee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum, Oregon's Attorney General, and I am delighted to be back and to have the opportunity to continue our discussions on budget proposals for the Oregon Department of Justice. So I will begin today's presentation by briefly reviewing my budget priorities. You have in front of you slide 2. Investments included in the governor's budget that I am prioritizing include continued implementation of the child support system, maintaining programs within crime victim services, in particular our criminal injuries compensation account, but of course the many other very important programs. Good afternoon. Enhancing our enforcement efforts in consumer protection and financial fraud, which does request a couple of additional positions. Replacing our legal case management system, including document management, which is quite antiquated and which is in need of pretty much complete replacement. Upgrading our public website, that's not on the list here, but very important in my priorities, for ease of communication with consumers and members of the public. It's been almost 10 years since we have had the opportunity to do that, and I feel that's very important. And while I realize that resources are extremely tight, I would like to emphasize two additional priorities that will be discussed today by Mr. Tweet, and you are also aware of these from our previous testimony. The first is addressing elder abuse investigation and prosecution statewide with an elder abuse resource prosecutor and two investigators, and also maintaining critical public safety support from our Fusion Center. Next, we'll present an overview of the budget, and I'm going to ask Mr. Boss to take over from here.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shields and Williamson and members of the subcommittee. My name is Fred Boss. I am the Deputy Attorney General. Before inviting the division administrators to present the details of their policy packages and the service impact of reductions, I will summarize the overall budget request. As we review the materials presented, please note that some of the budget numbers have changed since Phase 1. The Attorney General's requested budget totals just over $537 million for all fund types, including $83.6 million of general fund and $22.9 million from the criminal fine account. The pie chart reflects the distribution of the budget across the departments, 9 divisions and programs. You can note that 40% of the budget goes to our largest division, the Child Support Division, and our smallest division is the Appellate Division with only 4% of the budget. Federal funds, predominantly for the Child Support Program, support approximately 1/3 of the budget. The Legal Fund billable rates, or billable hours, support another 1/3 of the budget. Over 20% of the budget is supported by the general fund and criminal fine account, and the final 14% is supported by other dedicated sources of fundings, such as recoveries and fees. The requested budget reflects a 15% increase over the 2013-15 legislatively approved budget for all funds, and a 25% increase in general fund and criminal fine account allocations. We recognize that a request for a 25% increase in the general fund and criminal fine account allocation may seem aggressive. However, of the approximately $21 million increase, less than $1 million is in enhancement of services. Approximately $20 million retains existing services and commitments, including $8 million in additional debt services for the Child Support System Project, $5.5 million in defense of criminal convictions, approximately $3 million for changes in statewide compensation and inflation, $2.3 million to maintain critical crime victim services to offset a declining balance in punitive damages, and $1.2 million to retain the Fusion Center. The other fund budget request reflects an increase of approximately $31 million, including $12.4 million for the Child Support System Project, $8.5 million for statewide compensation and inflation, $7.7 million in policy packages, largely supported by the legal fund. We'll go into those packages in the presentation of the various administrators. $2.5 million reflecting a technical fund shift for the high-intensity drug trafficking program that Mr. Tweet, our chief counsel of the criminal division, will testify about. The federal funds budget reflects an increase of approximately $20 million, primarily attributable to two adjustments. These are $24.1 million of an increase for the Child Support System Project, and a $6.4 million decrease relating to HIDA. Before calling up the division administrators to discuss in more detail the policy packages and the reduction options, I would like to cover one more topic, and that is our legal fund hourly rate. ORS 180.160 and 180.170 authorize the Attorney General and the Department of Justice to charge for services provided, including an amount sufficient to provide a reasonable cash operating balance. As is typical to most law firms, charges are reflected in an hourly rate for service. While the DOJ rate model has been in existence far longer than the DAS customer utility boards, we can look to those guiding principles of rate setting for common themes. For example, all customers should pay the same rate for the same service. Subsidies should be avoided if possible. Rates must recover full cost of service, including all overhead and state government service charges. And the rates should be developed based on projected usage. This process, we start at the beginning of the budget development cycle, almost a year in advance of the legislative session. DOJ prepares an estimate of legal fund costs. This estimate follows the budget development guidelines established by the Department of Administrative Services for compensation estimates, inflation, and the allocation costs of centralized services. We also include an estimate of any policy packages that will be attributable to the legal fund services. Once we get this full estimate of the cost pool, the hourly rates are projected based on the number of legislatively authorized positions and the estimated total billable hours. Billable hours available to generate revenue are significantly influenced by a bargain contract with our attorneys' union. The projected rates will change throughout the budgetary development cycle, and they change as decisions are made in the governor's budget and the legislatively adopted budget. DOJ does utilize various hourly rates depending on the types of billers. So for attorneys, investigators, and paralegals, there will be a different billable rate. However, discussions on funding typically focus on the rate used for attorney hours, which account for approximately 75% of the hours billed. The proposed rate for attorneys in the biennium 2015-17 is $183 per hour. This is 15% higher than the current biennium rate of $159 per hour. The $24 per hour increase consists of $15.70 an hour for compensation and benefit changes, including the full roll-up costs of COLA adjustments from the current biennium and a projected increase in the 15-17 biennium. We will not know the actual cost of these adjustments until our labor negotiations are concluded. $4.50 an hour to cover standard inflation at 3% and state government services charges. $1.20 per hour for policy packages, and $2.60 an hour to provide a sufficient cash operating balance, which is an estimate of keeping 2 months of total budget in reserve. While the rate model is multifaceted, it is important to keep in mind all of the checks and balances. The most direct is the legislatively authorized budget, which establishes the number of positions that we have and limits the total amount of expenditures that we have, or the subject to the funding source. The positions and expenditures are delineated in the statewide budget systems in Orbitz and PICS and are subject to multiple audits by DAS. The rate model is submitted and reviewed by the DAS Chief Financial Office and the Legislative Fiscal Office a minimum of 3 times in the process. Estimates of the ending cash balances are submitted and reviewed by DAS and LFO to ensure that there is not excess cash retained and that the rates are not too high. This concludes my remarks. If there are no questions, I'd like to bring up the division administrators to discuss the specific policy option packages and reduction options.
Questions? Seeing none, let's do it. Dave, why don't you come back to this one here?
Thank you, co-chairs. I'm going to leave my spot, and our administrators will be taking my place along with Mr. Boss for future questions if you have any, but I will be available.
Thank you. $24 an hour. That's just a
chart. Good afternoon, co-chair Shields, members of the subcommittee. My name is Mark Williams, and I lead the Administrative Services Division for the Department of Justice. I'd like to begin my presentation by giving you a brief overview of the Administrative Services organization. Administrative functions included in the governor's budget are human resources, financial services, IT, and operations. This slide also reflects our admin support for the division, as well as how the policy packages are associated with each section. I'll speak individually about the one limited duration and the 4 positions requested. This is a budget comparison of administration by fund type. Admin is all other funded. The increase in positions is a result of policy package number 111. I will describe the pieces of that request in upcoming slides. There is $300,000 of general fund being phased out. I'll discuss that in the next slide. This is what our current service level budget looks like. It includes statewide calculations and the phase-out of our 1315 LFO analyst adjustments of Project Clean Slate and the mortgage mediation package. This is the $300,000 general fund from the previous slide. Slide 13. This slide reflects our policy package and technical adjustments. Policy package 111 consists of 5 positions and 4 FTE, representing just over $2 million in the governor's budget. Next, technical adjustments to policy package 111 include the reduction of 0.5 FTE resulting from the fiduciary transfer of HIDA administration and the addition of $2.8 million consisting primarily of updating our legal case management system and reducing our facilities footprint in both Portland and Salem. The first component of policy package 111 that I'll discuss is that of our operations function. This request is twofold. First, it is an increase in expenditure limitation to accommodate our long-term facilities plan and a limited duration Project Manager 1. Working closely with DAS Leasing, we anticipate that in the 2015-17 biennium, we will be consolidating facilities to make efficiencies in our real estate footprint. In order to achieve this long-term plan, there will need to be moves and relocations in a number of our locations. These plans include divisions returning closer to the Justice Building within our existing space, as well as divisions consolidating multiple locations into one. The projects will be complex with multiple facilities needs and will require critical planning and good project management skills by one limited duration project manager one position. Secondly, we're requesting the reclassification of three existing positions. The three positions are two project manager one to project manager two, and one procurement and contracts assistant to procurement and contract specialist one. Currently, the two project manager ones are working at the project manager two level and have been doing so for some time. Their responsibilities are to manage 21 facilities between them, as well as directing the processes and activities of multiple complex and significant risk projects of varying scope and size, including moves and relocations and construction of tenant improvements. On a daily basis, they are involved with working closely with other state agencies, special interest groups, contractors, and negotiating with landlords, as well as handling all issues related to the leases. Their responsibilities and projects are more complex in size and scope than that of a project manager one. The procurement and contract assistant position has been gradually assigned additional responsibilities. The requirement of this position to research, interact closely with suppliers, and have the ability to maintain greater relationships with vendors and achieve discount rates, provide cost comparisons, feedback, and recommendations to each division to get the most value has increased. Divisions rely heavily on this position for guidance and interaction with vendors.
Mr. Bender, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm not tracking. So we had the 15-17 current service level, and now we're modifying the new packages. So the packages we had for 15-17 are gone away, and now we're working on the modified, or the request is for both the modified and the ones we had before.
Co-chair and representative, the modified, from my understanding, is the governor's recommended budget plus additional policy packages above that. So that's how they get to modify. This is unique for the agency. You won't see other agencies doing this. Your other agencies are in presenting the governor's recommended budget. And so these are, again, additions above the governor's recommended budget to achieve that modified agency request line item.
So to clarify, please, Mr. Chair. So we're looking at approving the first one, the 15-17, those packages, and also the agency is asking for the additional modified.
Yes, I believe the rationale, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the Attorney General is an independently elected position, and they could present whatever they like.
Thank you.
Doesn't mean we have to fund it. But
thank you.
They can
I didn't understand if one washed away the other. We're
right.
Looking at both.
Thank gotcha.
You.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's on top.
Thank you very much.
Slide 15. Our HR request is to enable us to meet current and growing demand for employee services. The employee safety and workers' compensation position will coordinate agency site safety teams in every DOJ location. This position will act as a liaison between DAS Risk and Safety, SAFE, OSHA, and DOJ. It will conduct ergonomic assessment, train the trainer, and conduct ergonomic assessments on the more difficult cases for the agency.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Winters.
What's the experience to date with your workers' comp claims, number one? And number two, I noted that you talked about not only training, but also between other agencies. So can you provide some clarity for me?
Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, Senator Winters, as far as the workers' comp, I don't have that information with me, so I will get that information and get that sent back to you. As far as the details of what kind of training, what kind of work, I detailed this a little bit in our phase one presentation. This alludes to training about or concerning our earthquake drills, our employee safety drills, active shooter response training. There is training that I'm sorry, it's skipping my mind at the moment. There's training, various trainings about employee safety. On the top of my head, I can't think of all those, but I can get that list to you.
I ask that because you're asking for, this is a new policy package, so there has to be something that led you to the place to where the policy package was needed.
Yeah, I have that list. I'll need to get that to you separately.
Good. You can get it to Mr. Borden.
Okay, will do.
Please continue.
Okay. The proposed Human Resources Specialist 3 position is to assist the department in reducing risk. The organizational change and training involved in updating processes and educating employees are overwhelming, and the current staffing level of HR is not meeting the needs of the agency. As the agency grows, both in FTE and geographically, the need for employee support grows. The improvement brought by the HRA 3 and HR related functions will decrease the administrative costs spent in processing grievances, bully complaints, and notices of tort actions, in addition to the direct cost of paying out civil litigation awards through DAS risk management. This request is for an operations and policy analyst 3 position to drive accountability and efficiency in our financial operations. We recently commissioned an audit of our financial services. It helped us identify deficiencies in policy and procedure and presented scenarios for action. Several of the recommendations, including new metrics and procedures to ensure efficiency, will be coordinated by this position. It is also expected to conduct financial monitoring, reporting, and forecasting, provide support for the internal audit function by taking the lead on program analysis identified by internal audit and tracking resolution on findings, and also assist in the fiscal impact preparation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Because he mentioned DAS risk management. And so can I assume that the reason for these positions long-term is to reduce the risk management cost? And also, because I'm still going to go back to other agencies and other entities, as you know, it's been one of my interests to try to reduce the cost of risk management for some time, and whether or not you're going to be able to provide some consultation and direction to some of the other agencies other than DOJ.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that's exactly what that's intended to do. We have statistics where we're at today, and we'll be able to measure and mark what that difference is. This request is for replacing of the department's legal case and records management systems. The two most critical business systems used by all of our legal divisions are our electronic records management system and our legal matter or case management system. Our legal case management system, as noted on this slide, is homegrown, and although it was state-of-the-art when we built it, today it doesn't meet the needs of the legal divisions. The electronic records management system is an off-the-shelf product that has been customized over the years. Today, it has significant limitations and issues resulting in system crashes, data corruption, file locking, the inability to segregate data as required by federal regulations, and is a source of productivity loss. Our electronic records management system also houses over 6.5 million records. The current system does not have retention schedule or litigation hold functionality. Due to these problems, staff often store files outside of the system, leading to multiple data stores, resulting in increased backup costs. This also leads to increased public records requests, increased exposure and discovery process during litigation, and inefficient staff retrieval processes for information needed to complete our daily tasks. Replacing our system will eliminate those technical problems, increase productivity, and reduce risk to the state. We need to replace our current electronic records management system to address all of these issues and advance our agency's mission by providing a system that maintains a data integrity, complies with record retention, includes litigation hold requirements, and provides our users with a more efficient and effective tool to help them succeed in carrying out the duties and responsibilities of the department. Not replacing our system means our data will be difficult to access and our processes inefficient, putting at risk millions of dollars of revenue received as a result of the department's litigation activities. The estimated costs for this project include quality assurance services, hardware, off-the-shelf software, and implementation services consisting of software configuration, training, and transition services. Our final request in Policy Package 111 addresses the Attorney General website. Our request is to engage a consultant and hire a webmaster to design and deliver a website that meets the demands of constituents by providing easily accessible content and services, encourages and facilitates engagement with the department, and provides a platform for future change and growth. The department's website is old. With constituents demanding more online and mobile content and services, it is imperative that the department's and the Attorney General's web presence meet these demands with a website that communicates and facilitates the vision, mission, and goals of the Attorney General. It is responsive in design, meaning it's easily viewable on anything from PCs to mobile devices, and most importantly, delivers value to consumers. The current website doesn't offer what are now very common elements of a website, such as that responsive design, interactive forms, and consumer-driven content feeds. Here are just a few statistics to illustrate the importance of the department's web presence. There are 1.3 million visits per year to look up child support case status, case information, and most commonly, by far, payment information. Those visits come from approximately 130,000 citizens. It works out to about one visit every 10 seconds of the year. 2,000 parents use our child support calculator each month to run what-if scenarios for child support payments, allowing them to be more educated when they start working with our child support program. 3,300 employers signed up to do business with child support online last year. Employers made 110,000 payments totaling over $51 million through the online portal last year. Our main DOJ website receives 4,000 visits per day, while OregonChildSupport.gov receives approximately 7,000 visits per day.
Can I ask you a question about that? Right now, the 990s of charitable organizations are not online. Is that correct?
I don't.
Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, I don't believe they are online. We do have a fairly significant charities presence online, but I think, and we're moving that way. I don't believe that the actual 990s are, but that's where we're heading.
Would this policy option package?
This will be certainly part of this. Also, it would enhance the ability for charities to file with us online. So there are over 18,000 charities. This would help us to allow them to completely file with us online, put it into data, make it hopefully a data bank, so hopefully searchable by potential givers to charities.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Senator Bates.
I know this is a proper time to ask or not. Can we go back and look at your request for changing your IT system? That's got the slide number here.
I believe it's 17.
The 1.8 million. Okay. This looks, I mean, looking at what you're asking for, this looks like the most important one to me, frankly. You've got an aging system. The people who run it are retiring. This is information I understand. You're going to use COTS, which I appreciate. Have you looked at all the costs of this? I mean, you've got old systems. You've got to integrate somehow with this and bring them on board. I imagine there's some data you have to store for a certain length of time that may or may not be involved in this. And what do your ongoing costs look like? Are you have to hire new people to replace those who are retiring? Is this a more efficient system that actually costs less to run? What kind of support do you get from the people you're buying the system from? I think you're doing the right thing here. But we've been through this in other agencies. It hasn't always gone real well.
Understatement.
Okay. And just one of them was an agency I overlooked, and it was ugly. You know?
Co-chairs, Senator Bates, members of the committee, we're well aware of that, and what we've done is we've broken out the individual pieces of the project, including licensing costs for hardware and software, the integration costs, maintenance for the first year, as well as QA for the project as well. We've also determined the costs of maintaining an ongoing our ongoing system. So even though we're talking about replacing that system, it's written in 15-year-old technology. Wow. So updating the skills of those staff and utilizing new COTS, we'll be able to use those same individuals, and hopefully the efficiency of all of our users, our attorneys, our paralegals, all of our staff, in the efficiency they get from using the new system will hopefully bury all the inefficiencies of that old system. So we're quantifying each piece of that to make sure that we're not missing anything, because you're right, this is the most important one to us.
Follow up.
Has
LFO been involved looking at this and overseeing the program?
Co-chairs and senators, LFO is aware of this program. This is an expansion of it, though, I think, under this policy package, if I understand it correctly. So we would maybe. Bob Cummings will be looking at this in particular, and the IT subcommittee will also be looking about it, and I believe they've also heard about it as well.
Yes. Co-chairs, Senator Bates, members of the committee, we did take that to the IT subcommittee, and because of the amount being over $1 million, we will be working through LFO and through DAS in the CIO's office. So it's not something that we'll be doing without both their partnership and their oversight.
This is the last comment. This looks like a very small amount of money for what they're trying to do, and I'm just concerned that that there might have some bumps and surprises down the road. We've seen some systems come online doing very well. Judiciary, their electronic system has done well, stayed online, done a good job, done it for budget, did all the right things, and I'm not saying you won't, okay? But it's always a part we're looking at very, very carefully, and I think if LFO is on board, well, that's probably the best thing I can ask for right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, slide 19. In March, this is technical adjustment. In March of this year, the HIDA Executive Board made the determination to transfer the administrative fiduciary responsibility for HIDA to another agency. This request is simply for a technical adjustment, reducing one account and two position by 50%. Finally, I'd like to talk. Well, I don't want to talk. I need to talk about reductions. A 5% reduction means a loss of six positions or $1.44 million of other funds limitation for admin services. Reductions at this level consist of positions performing accounting, information technology, customer support, and business support. The loss of these positions will jeopardize our ability to plan, execute, and report on the department's program requirements, daily technology support, risk delays in making payments, and most likely not being in compliance with fiscal mandates. A 10% reduction means a loss of an additional seven positions or $2.88 million. Reductions at this level include positions performing business continuity planning, technology support, and accounting. In addition to the impacts described in the 5% section, this level of reduction requires the department cancel or delay IT projects necessary to efficiently deliver legal services and child support. Reductions in funding for technology staff or accounting staff will endanger DOJ's capacity to comply with state and federal mandates, as well as our capacity for maintaining and improving security of sensitive and confidential information and meeting reporting requirements. Reduction of information technology capacity will also result in a loss of revenue to multiple DOJ programs working to move services and collections to the internet for ease of use by clients, businesses, and citizens. And that's the POP I talked about earlier, the function I talked about earlier. Reduction of the accounting position translates to a significant delay in sending invoices for department legal work and an extreme increase in the likelihood of errors during the billing cycle. These reductions will result in responsibilities being moved to remaining staff members who are already at capacity. With this level of reductions, ASD will have to discontinue work currently being performed. The division is running critically thin and cannot take reductions of this magnitude without eliminating work that is critical to both DOJ programs and client agencies that DOJ supports. In addition, this reduction requires a significant reduction in services and supplies, which also cannot be sustained, as the services and supplies budget is already underfunded. This concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any additional questions you may have concerning the material I've presented.
Representative Krieger.
I wasn't listening real good, but I couldn't pick it off the slides. All agencies, driver, in most cases of costs, are employees. Programs are expanding programs. And I want to have a, maybe you can get a piece of paper. Plus I've got it in my other book. Percent of COLA, percent of pay increase, and do they get COLA, pay increase, and step increase, and how much of the step increases? Now, I realize that that changes from the type of employee that you've got. If you've got a janitor, he's not going to get the same as an attorney. I need to have some type of a thing to see what's driving these extra costs.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Krieger, we can get that information to you.
Anything else? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Darren Tweet. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. It's my pleasure to appear before you again today for Phase 2. I'm going to walk through, obviously, just our budget numbers, answer any questions you have, and talk about our policy packages and similarly to Mr. Williams, our reduction scenarios. So just to remind you, the Criminal Justice Division is a full-service support division for Oregon's prosecutors and state, local, and federal law enforcement agencies. I talked a great deal in the first phase about our general fund programs. I didn't touch at all, as you move to the right of these slides, on some of our federal funds programs. Just want to highlight those as we go through this, since the rest of our budget does obviously include federal and other funds. Particularly on the right side there in the criminal intelligence section, talk a little bit about the high-intensity drug trafficking area and initiative and the monies that we receive there directly from the U.S. government. The HIDTA program is composed of two different sections. The first section is the information service section. That is similar to the Fusion Center. It's a section that's composed of analysts, and they are able to provide case support on drug cases in HIDTA counties. In addition, we have the Watch Center, four positions there. The Watch Center is an on-call center for Oregon's law enforcement and federal, state, or local law enforcement officers that call in with particular kind of tactical requests. So a good example of what the White Watch Center will do is if a detective is conducting a case, they may call up and ask for information, an intelligence profile on a suspect or a witness that they might be contacting. Just tell us as much as you can using your databases, perform some research, and get back to us right away. During this biennium, there are approximately 8,000 of those types of intelligence profile requests that the Watch Center performed. In addition, another very important function of the Watch Center is to provide event deconfliction for law enforcement officers. And what that is if a detective or a SWAT team or a special unit is conducting some sort of an operation, they will let the Watch Center know the area of the operation, so that other law enforcement agencies can be aware of that. There are various methods and tools that we use in the Watch Center to maintain confidentiality of those investigations if we need to. And really the point of all of that is just to make sure that law enforcement officers don't get crosswise with each other when they're conducting their investigations. During this biennium, January 11th, we conducted approximately 3,600 of those types of event deconflictions for law enforcement officers throughout the state. So that is, and the other component of the HIDA program that we have is that we have been for a number of years the fiduciary for all of the federal funds that pass through Oregon to the various HIDA initiatives. We have also housed the management initiative. You heard in the previous presentation that the HIDA board has agreed to move the management initiative and the fiduciary responsibilities over to DPSST. And so as we go through the presentation, you'll see how that impacts our federal funds budget. This is the budget. As we walk through it, there are just a few areas that I would highlight for you, mainly under the 2015-17 modified agency requests budget. You'll see that we are increasing the size of the general fund. I talked extensively about the programs that we were requesting that you add that were not in the governor's budget. Those programs are the elder abuse prosecutor and two investigators that go along with that, and then maintaining and retaining the fusion center. Oh, can we go back one slide? Just for your information, you'll see a spike again in the purple on the bottom row in other funds and a corresponding reduction in federal funds. That is the transfer of the HIDA management initiative and the fiduciary responsibilities. So we're transferring out our responsibility for all the federal funds under that program, and then we will be left with receiving federal funds through that program for the ISC, the Information Services Center. And so that's why you see kind of the corresponding moves in those charts. Now, this is our 15-17 current service level. I do not have very much to say about that. I'll take questions, of course. I will point out package 21-021, which I'll talk a little bit more about, and you've heard quite a bit of testimony, both from the Attorney General and myself, relating to the elder abuse prosecutors. I will also talk about right now package 22. We have the limited duration positions for the DUI resource prosecutor. We receive a grant for that, and every biennium we phase that out and then phase it back in, of course, with your approval. So that actually is not a it is a limited duration program, but it has never really been subject to any concern. The DUI resource prosecutor has really provided a tremendous benefit to Oregon's prosecutors and law enforcement officers since its inception. Next. This is the 15-17 modified agency request budget. This is the packages that we are requesting above the governor's approved or governor's budget. And I will talk about these on slides later on, particularly relating to the Fusion Center, Package 141 and Package 142, which is the Elder Abuse Resource Prosecutor.
Darren, question. What has been the workload increase for, and I know that elder abuse is relatively new, but what does it look like the caseloads are beginning to look like as we beginning to implement more and more in elder abuse?
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Winters, and members of the committee. We have seen in 2013, I'll provide you the statistics for 2013 from Adult Protective Services, we had about 28,000 complaints of possible elder abuse during that time period. There were 14,000 that APS deemed worthy of investigation. And then of those, approximately 5,000 cases were actual confirmed cases of elder abuse. So that's a pretty dramatic set of numbers, and I understand that that the rate has increased approximately 17% of elder abuse. I cannot tell you whether that is because there is some new trend or if we're just now beginning to pay a lot more attention to it. I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Just reading some of the other literature, it appears as though the majority of the cases are financial. Is that?
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, Senator Winters, members of the committee, most of them are, at least in my experience and anecdotally. There are some really horrible experiences of physical abuse of elderly people by caregivers. But what we're seeing at the division and have seen for a number of years has been abuse of fiduciary responsibilities. As I testified during phase one, the Fusion Center has been general funded since the short session. It was all of those positions in the Fusion Center were made limited duration, and so we're requesting that they be made permanent. Without that, there are four positions that are general fund in the Fusion Center that will go away, and we will not be able to sustain the program any longer. We currently have two positions that are other funds. Those two positions are really tied to the grants which sustain them and cannot perform all of the work of the Fusion Center. Without these four general fund positions, we just would not be in a position to be able to continue the program as a whole. Since the last time that I testified to you, we had another really good example of some of the tangible benefits that the Fusion Center provides to law enforcement in Oregon. In 2012, so every year Portland area, metro area agencies apply to the federal government for funding for emergency equipment and for items that they can use in response to all types of emergencies, and that's through the Urban Area Security Initiative processes. In 2012, when the Fusion Center was in a similar set of circumstances, we did not participate in the grant requests for Portland UASI. So that was 2012. In 2013, the Portland area UASI received no federal funding. They were bumped down lower in the list than they had been in previous years. And I believe that that was in large part due to the fact that the Fusion Center did not assist them in putting together their grant. In 2014, because the Fusion Center had been given this funding to continue, we were able to kind of come in at the last minute and support their request and provide a bunch of technical information to DC, and the Portland area UASI was able to receive $1 million. This year, we were able to participate in a much earlier stage of that proceeding, and the Portland UASI area received $3 million. So we've gone from zero to one to three each year, showing you the value, I think, the value that the Fusion Center provides in just one small area of Oregon. There are other examples. I'm not going to go through all of those. I talked a lot about the Fusion Center and what it does in the previous phase. This is a very critical program both to the state and to the Department of Justice. I've talked about the benefits to the state. Without the Fusion Center analyst, we will be severely limited in the types and the complexity of cases that we can investigate and prosecute. The analysts are just key in any case that involves any large amount of data. Package 142 relates to the elder abuse prosecutor and two criminal investigators. I already talked about the numbers. Senator Winters stole my show on that. This is very critical, I believe, to the state. I know you've heard from the Attorney General. You've heard from me. I'm happy to entertain questions about this. I believe that this is kind of the next wave of crime that we're going to see in Oregon. Package 143 are the continuing grants that I referred to. We phased out the DUI prosecutor because that is a grant. We're asking to phase that back in. And in addition, similarly situated, we have two agents that are funded through federal money for ICAC. We phase that out and then phase that back in every biennium. Package 147 is a technical readjustment, which really is at this point virtually moot since the HIDA initiative, the management initiative, and the fiduciary duties are transferring over to DPSST. Next slide. I've already talked about, I'll entertain questions about the fiduciary transfer if you like. And then we unfortunately go to reduction options. Criminal Justice Division is not very much different from any other division in the Department of Justice. Most of our costs are personnel related. So when we start talking about 5 and 10% general fund reductions, we're talking about losing people. The first 5%, we would have to cut back approximately 80 cases. I would work with the Attorney General's office, obviously, to determine what types of cases we're going to cut 80 of. But I've already told you, we investigate and prosecute homicides, child pornography, organized crime, and very complex cases that perhaps a local district attorney working alone or a local agency working alone couldn't do. So we would have to really sit down and try to figure out how deep the cuts are going to go and where we're going to go with those types of cases. That's just the first 5%. From there, we're going to have to reduce approximately the same amount. And at that point, I think we would not just be looking at individual types of cases or individual cases. We would be looking wholesale at categories of cases that we would no longer be able to investigate or prosecute. And again, that would require really hard work with the Attorney General's office in order to determine where we're going. With that, that is my presentation. I'm happy to take any questions.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Winters.
I don't have any questions, but I can't help but kind of help somebody brag a little bit because I understood that there's a son of Mr. Tweets who I thought was going to play at Volcano Stadium, and that's been delayed, as I understand it. Because I promised to post it when the game's over if they win. He's got a wonderful, wonderful son who's at that actually has a wonderful arm. And I was there when he did his signing to go to the university. So congratulations, Father.
Thank you very much. Those are very kind words. And May 13th is the reschedule.
That was 18th.
Oh, it is. 18th. Right. 18th. Thank you.
I went.
Yes.
Senator Bates.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry to be a buzzkiller here. I'm scared to ask you a question. This is a new budget to me, and I just want to ask LFO to look carefully at package 03 because I don't quite understand it. It's standard above standard inflation. It lists 1.2 million plus and total here of, I'm sorry, 1.4 million. General funds 860, and then other funds, which I assume are assessments on state agencies, which is really other funds. There's a federal fund match. I just don't understand the phrase standard above standard inflation. The SNS accounts, supplies and services, price list changes, adjustment of state government services. I have to take a good look at that. So that seems a little kind of a strange way to put things in. It goes back to what Representative Krieger is talking about, I think, really. And it's not a huge amount of money, but just eyeball it for us later on. And that will take more time with the committee.
All right. Darren, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Shields, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Udlin. I am the Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division. As you can see from our organizational chart, which I discussed at length the last time we were here, the work of the Civil Enforcement Division is generally divided into five sections, and I won't go through each of them, but I will be touching on a number of them today as we go forward. In general, the Civil Enforcement Division is the plaintiff side litigation for the state of Oregon, with a few exceptions here and there. This chart represents our budget comparison. As you can see, the vast majority of the funds for the Civil Enforcement Division are other funds. The work of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section is fully self-funded through the work of that unit. The work of the Charitable Activities Section is fully funded through fees assessed against charities. The work of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit is funded 75% federal funds, and the remainder of the 25% is funded self-funded through the work of the unit. That leaves a small portion of our civil enforcement budget that is funded in general fund. The general fund components are a very small amount that goes to civil rights matters, and the remaining part is divided among two tobacco programs. We have our obligation to comply with the requirements of the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement to diligently enforce our escrow statutes, and then we litigate with the participating manufacturers regarding our annual payments. Both of these elements protect the nearly $160 million the state of Oregon receives from tobacco manufacturers each biennium. As you can see from the chart, there's a little spike in purple in our modified agency request budget, and that is due to our policy package requests. It's a primarily a request and limitation, and I will discuss those as we go through the presentation. This chart shows our current service level budget. Our entire budget for the Civil Enforcement Division is $75 million. This is broken down into $67 million in other funds, $3.5 million in federal funds, and $3.75 million in general fund. And as you can see, a vast majority of our budget is in personal services. That's the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General time and our staff time. Next, we have our agency request budget, our modified request. As you can see, we're requesting a budget for civil enforcement of $80 million. This is broken down into $72 million of other funds, $3.5 in federal funds, which remains the same from current service level, and approximately $4 million in general fund. It's important to note that of the $5 million increase over current service level, $4.5 million of that is in other fund limitation, and it is only the remaining $250,000 or so that is in general fund request. We have three requests for investment and two technical adjustments, which I will discuss shortly.
Mr. Chair. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you going to talk about the mortgage mediation, $2.6 million, in a later slide?
Yes, co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I will get to that. That's near the end of the presentation.
Thank you. And another question, follow on real quick. Go back to the last slide. Can you tell us, how much of the other funds is to the tobacco settlement? Is it half of it, a third of it?
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, the tobacco is funded from general fund. We have approximately $700,000 in the enforcement piece, and then the $3 million in the enforcement litigation with the PMs. And there's a small slice in other fund, and I can't tell you that number right now. I apologize.
Mr. Chair, I thought that was a large, but you're showing the other funds is $73 million.
If I can just step in, yeah. Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, Representative Wisnett, if I understand you correctly, the income that comes in from the tobacco manufacturers does not come anywhere near our agency, unfortunately. It goes directly into the Treasury and then is paid out according to some set principles in Treasury.
You don't get any of that.
We do not get any of that.
Thank you.
They just litigate.
Well, but I know from, Mr. Chair, from experience, they did take some from the bank settlement, and that's why I look forward to seeing how that goes. Thank you. Testimony on that.
Okay.
Thank you. The first policy package we have is number 132. That is a financial fraud and consumer protection workload request. We are requesting $794,000 in other fund limitation. There are a number of factors underlying our request. Since 2009, there have been more than 10 new areas added to the Unfair Trade Practices Act. These range in complexity from floral sales to veterans issues, debt management providers to false claims and athlete agents. While no one additional area is driving our request, when added together and combined with the complicated marketplace consumers are operating in today, this has led to the need for additional staffing. Overall, we have found that cases that are among the most important to large numbers of Oregon consumers tend to be the more complex cases. For example, pharmaceuticals, medical devices, telecommunication issues, and antitrust matters. These cases overall require greater upfront investment of attorney time and resources on our part, but the payoff is a higher impact on a wider range of Oregon consumers. For example, attorneys in the unit recently worked on a price-fixing case relating to computer chips. We invested over 7,000 hours of attorney time and incurred $100,000 in expenses in pursuing the case. But as a result, the defendants paid $310 million to consumers. Oregon government agencies will receive $375,000, and we will be repaid our attorney time and expenses. The number of complicated cases we are seeing has dramatically increased the number of hours our attorneys spend on active litigation. That is, cases requiring court appearances, depositions, and detailed extensive discovery. At any given time, a financial fraud and consumer protection attorney carries a caseload of 10 to 30 cases. Now, this, of course, depends on the type of case, as attorneys handling larger, more complicated, and contentious matters will have fewer cases and vice versa. While this may not sound like much, cases in active litigation where we are filing motions, taking depositions, and appearing in court carry an intensive time commitment. To support our work, we're asking for other fund limitation increase of, I think I mentioned, $794,000. This represents five positions, one legal secretary, two paralegals, and two assistant attorney generals. We estimate the package will enable the section to pursue an additional 30 to 65 cases per year, all to the benefit of Oregon consumers.
And to be clear, that would be completely funded through proceeds that you get from taking these cases and winning them.
Co-chairs, Senator Shields, yes, that's correct.
Sounds like a good idea.
Next, we have policy package number 133. This is our defense of the tobacco MSA package. We are requesting $243,000 in general fund to support the hiring of a limited duration FTE to support our work. As I discussed in more detail in our original presentation, we are currently litigating with the tobacco companies whether the state of Oregon, including the Department of Justice, diligently enforced our escrow statutes in the calendar year 2004. The case will be handled in arbitration in a similar matter to the hearing we had for calendar year 2003, which we won. Although the arbitration panel is not yet in place, we expect that to occur in the next few months. At risk in this arbitration is Oregon's entire MSA payment for calendar year 2004, which is approximately $70 million. And I would note that states who lost the 2003 case did lose their actual entire payment for calendar year 2003. Generally, we do the work in this area through outside counsel because the work of the state of Oregon is at issue, and to a large extent, what DOJ has done. At the same time, we want to mitigate our costs as much as possible, and we do that by bringing in limited duration attorneys to help with document review and other matters so we can bring the cost down. So we're asking you to continue to fund that for us so we can reduce our costs. Our next policy package is 70 and 135, which is our charities fee increase. The work of the charitable activities section is fully funded by fees paid by charities, and these fees are based on a charity's assets and revenues. We are requesting fee increase limitation, and I want to note this is the first time we have requested a fee increase since 1985. The purpose of the fee increase is to sustain the work of this unit, investigating and taking appropriate action regarding deceptive charitable solicitations, recovering charitable assets when necessary, and providing extensive education to charities and their board members regarding their fiduciary responsibilities. Without the fee increase, we will have fewer attorney and staff hours to regulate charitable activities and gaming, and this would result in a diminished ability to protect Oregon's charitable assets and to litigate where necessary. So our specific packages, package 70, is a reduction that would be required if we had no fee increase. Package 135 reverses the effect of package 70 and allows the program to continue at existing service levels and provides us with that additional other fund limitation. If approved, the Department of Justice would implement the fee increase through administrative rulemaking in our 2015-2017 biennium. I note that we expect the fee increase to support the work of the unit for the next 5 years, and that the Nonprofit Association of Oregon is generally supportive of our fee increase request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the estimated revenue, is that net or gross?
Net, do I have that?
For charities, we said estimated revenue.
Co-chairs and Senator Wisnett, are you asking, I believe I was saying the fee is based on the charity's revenue?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, and I'm going to show you a chart here in just a moment. Okay.
But is it the net amount they receive or they get to take off their expenses?
Senator Shields, Representative Williamson, Representative Wisnett, I'll have to look into that and get back to you.
Okay. No, thank you.
So what does the fee increase mean for a charity? currently, if you, under the current fee schedule, if you are a charity that makes less than $25,000 in revenue each year, you pay an annual fee of $10. Under the proposal, that same charity that made under $25,000 would pay, the highest they would pay is a fee of $30. If you're a charity with assets of $1 million, you currently pay $200 per year. Under the proposal, we would raise that to $400 a year. I will also note, you can see the boxes in the bottom. Charities also pay a fee based on their assets. We will be increasing that from $1,000 to $2,000. I think it's important to note that charity does not pay the $2,000 fee, which is the maximum fee, until they have assets of $10 million.
Can I ask you a question? That would include private foundations as well.
Senator Shields, representatives, I believe so, yes.
And nonprofit insurance companies? Sorry. Please proceed.
I have, we'd like to also discuss two technical adjustments we have. The first is in our mortgage mediation program. The Oregon law requires lending institutions to mediate with their borrowers prior to foreclosure proceedings, and this is done through the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Mediation Program. The Department of Justice sets the fee structure, adopts rules necessary to implement the program, and appoints a mediation service provider that handles the day-to-day program operations. The participants in the program are required to pay participation fees, which cover the cost of the program. DOJ simply passes through the participation fees to the mediation service provider. We expect the volume of mediation cases to remain steady at 25,000 cases in the next biennium. Our request is a technical adjustment in other fund limitation. We would like to increase our expenditure limitation by $2.6 million, which would be payments to our mortgage mediation coordinator, our service provider, to allow the program to continue at the projected volume of cases for the next biennium.
I'll have to look. I'll look at this offline with LFO. My concern is we're really short in the housing service for their counseling services and their advertising, and we're nowhere near 25,000 cases. So I'll do it offline and talk to LFO. If that's okay, Mr. Chair, I'm looking at this.
Any response, or?
Senator Shields, Representative Williamson, co-chair, or members of the committee, I'm happy to answer questions later if you have them. But.
Thank you.
And our last technical adjustment relates to Cover Oregon. This is a technical adjustment, again, in other fund limitation to allow us to continue the Attorney General's litigation against Oracle under the Oregon False Claims Act. The case is based on Oracle's role in the failed Cover Oregon State of Oregon Healthcare Insurance Exchange and is an effort to hold Oracle responsible and to recover funds spent by the State of Oregon.
And I think you've hit on this before, but refresh my memory of how this is other funds. Where are those other funds coming from?
Senator Shields, Representative Williamson, members of the committee, this is funded through our protection and education account.
Okay.
And last but not least, I have our 10% reductions. As with any other division within the Oregon Department of Justice, we would spread our reductions throughout our programs.
$200 million we were in lost.
We would see a reduction in our general fund program, a reduced ability to pursue civil rights actions. We would have a reduction in our ability to work on both our tobacco matters, which would directly put our full MSA payment at risk each year. In our other fund programs, a 10% reduction in our civil legal budget would reduce staffing in our child advocacy program up to 9 positions. This puts a number of Oregon children at risk of injury or death due to remaining in unsafe family situations. It lengthens the time necessary to establish permanent situations for children. In our protection and education account, a 10% reduction would be approximately 3 positions, which would reduce our ability to protect consumers from fraudsters, scam artists, and telemarketers. In our charitable activities section, a 10% reduction would eliminate our gaming section. This is the section that regulates raffles and bingo and other types of gaming activity. The section works to ensure that these legalized forms of gambling are operated by bona fide nonprofits, are run fairly, and employees are not skimming revenue. Without the program, we would return to 1988 when these programs were unregulated and many abuses occurred. Lastly, in our Medicaid fraud control unit, a reduction of 10% would reduce the unit by 2.5 positions. This would reduce our ability to prosecute Medicaid fraud throughout Oregon, reduce the ability to assist district attorneys, and reduce our ability to provide statewide training on healthcare fraud and elder abuse. And that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer questions.
Representative Krieger, you have a question?
Yeah, the Oracle lawsuit. Maybe you need to have someone come to my office and kind of confidentially talk to me about that.
Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, Representative Krieger would be happy to do that.
Mr. Joe, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Chair Shields. I should have asked this, or it's been talked before, but the Medicaid fraud fund, I think that's good for the public and the taxpayers that we do that. I don't see it having to balance out, but is our expenses and what we're recovering or stopping, is it close to balancing, or is it...
Co-chairs and members of the committee, Representative Wisnett, we receive 75% federal funds, and then we self-fund the other 25%. We are able to do that within our budget.
So
yes.
It's worth it, you think?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, Shannon.
Thank you. Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Shannon Savell, I'm the Director of the Crime Victim Services Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. This is the org chart you are probably very familiar with at this point. The highlighted portions are representative of policy packages that we'll discuss later on and positions that would be cut if we don't receive additional funding. This slide simply shows the different streams that fund the Crime Victim Services Division, much like everyone else's slides. And I think the one thing that's notable here is that you'll see that our funding is consistent over the last few years across the different funds. With respect to current service level, the only thing I would draw your attention to is Package 022, which is the phase out of a limited duration grant that we'll be discussing a little bit later in the presentation. And then here's the modified agency request, which encompasses the four packages that I would like to highlight for you. Beginning with the most important to me, and I think to crime victim services around the state, due to a decline in punitive damages, which we discussed at length in my previous presentation, we find ourselves in a significant budgetary shortfall. At the time we compiled the presentation, it was $4.2 million. It has since been reduced as we've run some projections. Only thing I'd really like to note here as far as the programs themselves is that these are programs that the state has historically relied on CVSD to provide and that we have been able to do so through the Punitive Damage Fund. Over the last several years, since I started, we identified that there was a reduction in our projected punitive damage awards. As a result, we've reduced staffing positions, we've gone paperless, we have now automated and provided that victims can apply to our compensation program online, which limits further need for staffing in the office. But with all of that, we still find ourselves in the position of being 9 positions short. This policy package represents 9 positions, 3 programs, and 2 grants, actually. That's my mistake. I said 1 when we did this. What I think is particularly notable about these is that these programs are very significant for the state of Oregon, and we did discuss them at length, and I'll highlight them briefly. But the programs are the positions. So, for instance, if you eliminate one of the positions, that might be the Crime Victim Services Victims' Rights Coordinator. She is not just a position. She runs the Victims' Rights Coordination Program for the state of Oregon. So she's the person that coordinates with the district attorney's offices and works on mediating and remediating informal violations of victims' rights before they hit the formal, they move into the formal process. Again, another position would be the domestic violence resource prosecutor. If that position is cut, the state's domestic violence resource prosecution program is eliminated, which is the training across the state for prosecutors and law enforcement. And then lastly, one of the third program would be the crime victims, victims assistance, the advocate program. Sorry, it's the crime victims advocate. And what she is required to do is to provide notice to victims of crime as cases move into the post-conviction phase, and she also accompanies them to court. So, again, those three positions also represent programs that benefit the entire state. The rest of the positions are our claims examiners, our claims assistants, so the people that help to evaluate and ultimately pay crime victims' compensation claims. The two grants are the $500,000 grant to the Sexual Assault Task Force and the grant that funds the District Attorney Victims Assistance Programs throughout the state. It took me a moment. The numbers are slightly different. So this is the package I referenced earlier that was phasing out. This is the grant coordinator. It's the Intimate Partner Violence and Pregnancy Grant. It phases out, and we anticipate that it will be renewed by the federal government, so we'll be asking to continue this grant. This is our position reclassification. I wrote down the exact terminology I was asked to use, which is I am requesting an increase in expenditure limitation. These positions are entirely federally funded, or almost entirely federally funded. They've been approved by DAS, and I believe the reclassification began through the union. So this is a process that we've been involved in. They are currently working at this at a new class, and we're asking for the additional expenditure authority. And then perhaps most importantly for this group, the 10% reduction options. I think one of the things that's important to note with these is that the assumption I make is that if we are making 10% reductions, you probably have not provided the $4 million in additional funding I've requested. And so what we'd be then looking for at this point is a reduction in staffing at CVSD to the point where we would no longer be able to administer the grants that we are provided through the federal government and would not be able to process, evaluate, and make the payments in the Crime Victims Compensation Program. And unfortunately, that's just kind of the tip of the scale. The reality is that most of these 10% reductions go directly to the actual victim services programs throughout the state. So, for example, the 10% cut to the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services, those funds go directly to the nonprofit domestic violence and sexual assault service programs in the state. They received $8.4 million in the last biennium. You doubled their budget, so they've doubled capacity and are addressing their KPMs and reducing the unmet shelter request bed numbers. But then we would then, through this, we would have a cut of almost $1 million to that program. So then they would be reducing the capacity they've just built up to address victim services. The address confidentiality program would be eliminated. As you can see, the budget is about $110,000. And the rest of the cuts follow similarly. The Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program, you restored that program to its 2009 service levels or budget levels in the last biennium, so we would be then going backwards from there with the 10% cuts. And then it's the same with the CFA dollars for both the CAMI programs and the District Attorney Victims Assistance Programs would lose FTE. So again, we'd be looking at programs that now probably have a 0.75 to 1 FTE, would be reducing those FTE across the state. And then you get to CVSD, and it would further reduce my staffing, primarily in, again, the compensation section, which administers the victims' compensation program, because the other side is federal funded. So we would remain whole and be able to administer VOCA grants, but anything that came through the state we'd be largely unable to process.
Okay. Any questions? Is that it?
That's it.
All right. And that's the last one for today.
Okay.
any final words, Mr. Borden, about where we're going?
No, co-chair and members of the subcommittee, just a quick reminder, work session first thing tomorrow when you meet, and then we'll resume with the agency's presentation.
All right. Great.
Thank you
very much. This meeting is adjourned.
Finding a working body. I need to go. I may not be here. We are. I need to go. I may not be here. We are.